Well, good day and welcome to another episode of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we have an exciting episode for you with a worldwide international set of our panel tonight. So we're going to get to that in just a second. But of course, before we have to do that and go all the way across the Atlantic Ocean, we have to go the other direction, most of the way across the United States from where I am on the East Coast, to Sam in Colorado. Sam, how's it there?
Quite cold and very drizzly, and it's been gray all day. And, you know, it's a big change from the nice weather we had all week. but we got our Becky DePodwin back from, you know, globetrotting, if you will. But she bought a house, so she's going to have to stay put for a while, I think. So, Becky, is there any other hurricanes going on out there? I haven't been paying strict attention. So what's up with the weather?
Nothing too crazy. There is the remnants of Hurricane Oscar that's going to be impacting actually Chris's part of the world, kind of, depending on where you are. But it's going to be impacting Ireland and the northern part of Great Britain. So it'll mostly, I think, just be really gusty winds, downpours. Winds could be potentially damaging, maybe some travel disruption. So that is the remnant of Hurricane Oscar that will hit later this week to the British Isles. Otherwise, knock on wood, it's all quiet in the tropics, and that's a very good thing. We are winding down the season, still have a month left. It does go through the end of November, so can't really rule anything out yet. There is a typhoon, a U2, that's Y-U-T-U, out kind of in the South China Sea right now, just impacted the northern part of the Philippines. And that's going to kind of curve north to just miss Hong Kong, where my husband actually is right now. So I'm glad it's missing him there. And then hit Taiwan, but it won't be too bad when it gets there. It should be mostly just some rain, tropical depression. So back to the U.S., Halloween is obviously tomorrow night, so kind of we're wondering what the weather is going to be for that. Probably the biggest concern is going to be some thunderstorms, severe storms for Texas, Louisiana. So that could be an impact for trick-or-treaters. And then, you know, because it never stops raining in the eastern part of the U.S. this year, there's going to be more rain in the Tennessee and Ohio valleys. That means more rain for me. It seriously has rained so much this year. And then, Sam, you're a part of the world, maybe not where you are specifically, but Colorado is definitely getting a snowstorm today, mostly in the high terrain. It's not snowing where you are, though.
Well, they said it could possibly, but to be honest, we haven't even gotten that much rain. Something about Greeley, I don't know. The storms kind of go around us sometimes. I'm not quite sure why that happens, but yeah, that's,
yeah.
We could use a little wet, but I'm not ready for the white stuff.
But it's the end of October. It's coming.
It's getting there. Yeah. What's it like on the East Coast, Jamie, this time of year?
Well, pick a day and it'll be different. That's all I have to say about that. I mean, seriously, it's been kind of chilly and a little wet with some rain coming through here and there. And but heck, you know, 2 days from now, it could be 75, 80 degrees. So I don't know.
Yeah, that kind of like the way it is here, especially in the fall. Well, I am very pleased with our guest tonight. He's another one of our community, and it's very nice that Becky covered the weather for the UK, because that's where he happens to be. And I guess we caught it exactly on the right week between their time change and ours yet to come. We're not getting him up quite in the middle of the night, which is really kind of nice. But we got Chris Chapman with us. Who posed a question in the Facebook group, and we're going to address that question. Hi, Chris. Why don't you tell people about yourself?
Hi, Sam. Thanks for having me on. So I'm based over in Suffolk in the UK, so on the East Coast with the North Sea next to us, and I'm currently working within the health sector. So I work within the as an emergency planning manager within the health sector and across with our local resilience forum. So I was quite interested to find out how what we do matches up with what you guys do, because obviously you have some pretty big storms that have rolled in recently, and how your responses are scalable, and a little bit about how ours is scalable.
Yeah, and we were kind of chatting back and forth about, you know, what do different countries have that, you know, commits different agencies, especially federal agencies, to disaster. I got a lot of questions running around in my head, and I'm sure Jamie and Becky will too. Interesting you should mention Suffolk because I've been, doing my ancestry DNA, and I got a lot of relatives there, ancient relatives, but maybe we're related in some way. You never know. So you mentioned that in the UK, you're bound by the Civil Contingencies Act from 2004, which makes responding agencies cooperate and work together. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so up until sort of like the turn of the century, a lot of our ways of responding were based on old Cold War methods, you know, civil protection, and very much based down that road. And it often involved, you know, all different agencies standing in a different corner of the car park and not really talking to each other. So after we had a number of big incidents at the end of, you know, sort of in the 90s, we had fuel strikes. We had quite severe flooding. We also had a big foot and mouth outbreak. And also the sort of the changing climate around the world. We were facing the fact that, you know, we couldn't talk to each other. We were struggling to work together. Who did what? So after changes, you know, and including 9/11, that helped trigger this legislation. It put duties, or, you know, the Act talks about putting duties on different categories of responders. So we have the category one responders, which would be your blue lights. So your police, fire, ambulance, but also your local authority. So your city and district councils, your county councils, and also our the environment agency, who sort of responsible for flooding and all environmental incidents, to try and sort of make sure that they shared information, they cooperated. And then there was the category two responders. So they tend to be like your utility suppliers, your telephones, your gas, your electricity, because ultimately in an incident people want to be able to call people, they want to heat their homes, and we sort of need electricity so that we, you know, keep the lights on. So, you know, this act came along, and it's still an evolving process. You know, we're still every time trying to be better, and that's what we aim for.
You know, we've talked a lot on this show about the different types of responding agencies, especially on the federal level, that Joe and I both work for. What types of it? Well, let me ask you this first. Let's start at the bottom. So all emergencies start locally, okay? And then when it overwhelms the local, they go out to other counties or so forth. And then it kind of trickles up to the state. I'm curious what the UK does. Do they have state teams? Do they have disaster teams? Well, you don't have states, but you have something like that. Counties.
Yeah, we have counties,
jurisdictions.
So,
yeah.
So under the Act, something called local resilience forums were formed on police boundaries. So those forums where all the responders get together. Now, in my part of the world, we get together every other Wednesday and find time to talk with each other, work on plans, so that when we pick up the phone, I could be calling up someone in police and say, you know, hi, it's Chris, and they know who I am and know what I'm asking for. So really building those links. Now, our police forces, our fire services, they have mutual aid agreements with surrounding counties. If there is something big coming up, let's say North Sea surge, and as Becky said, we've got Oscar head barreling our way. Be interested to see if that comes down the North Sea, because it's going to be quite a deep depression. That could bring a surge with it. It's unlikely, it's too early in the year. But, you know, if we had something like we saw in 2013, when we had quite a big surge come down, our fire services and police services are going out to their surrounding counties, bringing in national assets. So we do have them scattered about the country, and they just move them to where they're required. So they've got floodwater rescue teams that can be brought in. They've got search and rescue teams that, you know, can be put on standby. We can start, you know, what we don't do very often is call in the military. We can often do it within the civilian services, but they are available to us should we need them.
Ah, that's good to know. It sounds like what you're describing is much like our FEMA assets, the search and rescue, the USAR, the kind of stuff that Joe does. Do you have federal or national medical assistance teams like we do?
So I am not based within our ambulance service, but yes, we do have teams which are more regionally based, but then they can bring in assets from other regions. But if we've got one part of the country being affected, it's possible, it's probable that, you know, the other half of the country is being affected as well. So that would be reviewed by, so for health, it would be the Department of Health. And if required, they can help move kit around. And we just have to sort of see how it plans out. And, you know, we're planning for these things days out. You know, we can see what's coming and start moving kit to where we need it.
Very good. Well, the National Health Service is kind of the overall organization that's people care. Would that be correct?
Yes. The NHS, God bless it. That we're very lucky. You know, I listen to your podcasts and hear about how your different ambulance services are all sort of different parts of, you know, different companies in some cases, different organizations. But our emergency ambulances are all NHS assets. They're all run, you know, they're based on a regional footprint. They've got people trained to, you know, right up to the sort of, I saw some pictures on the Facebook group, you know, where you've got your tactical EMS. We have hazardous area response teams that can do similar things, but they are regional assets and will be brought in as and when needed. And because it's all the NHS, because it's all regional, it can be moved around. I mean, you can't move a hospital, but we are always looking for ways to help move people and assets.
Yeah, I had a friend, still have a friend, who's in the north of UK, and he did that for a while, where he had a single vehicle, and I don't know what you guys call them. We call them, you know, strike cars or whatever else, where he would go out to an incident and then determine what the other resources needed to be. And it seemed like his scope of practice medically was much more thorough than ours was at the time. So I just thought I'd throw that in. So you, your day job, you mentioned, involves the Health and Social Care Act. Can you tell us more about that specifically?
So in 2012, there was a big change to the way the health service was run. And I work for a clinical commissioning group, and they are the local groups that decide how funding is going to be allocated, how we will fund, you know, various different services. And they really work on how what the local area needs. So I work within one of those. And our role is very much to be that sort of tactical lead within the health economy in our sort of LRF, Local Resilience Forum area. So so as the Emergency Planning Resilience Manager, I'm not operational. I'm not on the ground. I'm not going out to these areas. I'm very much the tactical advisor, that works with our directors. And when we need to start moving patients around, doing repatriations, or if we need to, you know, get more resources in, I'm working with them to achieve that. But equally pulling together our wider provider network. So, you know, do we need to find space in residential homes? Do we need to look for homes in the community? Do we need to start moving patients out of hospitals because there's been a big incident? Where can we help the hospitals who are going to be busy dealing with sick people to find places to move the less sick people to? So it really did change the way that we work, but it has put us neatly in the middle between the providers doing the operational, we're the tactical, and then above us is the overall NHS England, who are giving us that strategic lead. They are where we go to and say, we need more help, or, right, this is what we're doing. Can you help facilitate it? But equally, they will feed down to us and tell us what they want, how they want this incident to pan out. So it's a great place to sit, all in the middle of it. But I sometimes describe it to people when I'm training them that we sit in the middle of the spider's web, keeping hold of, keeping tabs on everything. But it's all about cooperating and coordinating. And, you know, you can write any debrief, and the first thing you write on the top is communication, coordination. You know what the themes are going to be. So we're just trying to get ahead of that.
Well, Chris, personally, I think you're missing all the fun not being out in the field, but
I've done some of the in the field stuff, and you're right. It is good to get out there, but this role has me indoors at the moment.
Well, sometimes that's a good thing. Jamie, any thoughts or questions from you?
Well, yeah, I had a question because I was thinking back to the recent hurricane that hit the U.S., you know, when Michael hit the Gulf Coast and down on the Florida panhandle. You know, it caused quite a bit of devastation. And we brought assets in from, heck, as far away, almost 1,000 miles, maybe 1,500 kilometers or more. And I'm curious, if you have an area of the UK that's stricken, and can you bring assets in from, say, France or Ireland or some other EU nation? I know Brexit's going on, but until that happens, are there mutual aid agreements between the nations?
Yeah, because Scotland's part of the UK.
So. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. 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 So if we deal with that sort of like the home nations, if you like, so we've got England, Wales, Northern Ireland, Scotland. There are agreements in place that we will, you know, work together. We're not going to let an invisible border help, hinder response. International aid, which that would be, is a slightly different kettle of fish, and that would have to go up to sort of government. And you probably hear, if you ever see the news, a COBRA committee would, you know, you would have to go the whole way up, and that question would be asked. I'm sure it would be offered. Heaven forbid, in touch wood, that we ever have to ask for it. But they do exist. They do exist. Whether or not we would need to use them is a different matter, because, you know, we've got the resources. It's just getting them there.
And I assume that works both ways.
Yeah, absolutely.
Especially in the northern part of the UK, if something huge happened in Scotland, they may call for resources on the northern part of the country.
Yeah, without doubt. Without doubt.
So, Becky, thoughts?
Nothing for me just yet. I'm just kind of listening and taking it all in. Kind of waiting for you guys to get really into the weather stuff.
that's kind of where I'm going. What, Chris?
So I was going to say with the weather stuff, my part of the world, that we're in sort of the Suffolk and Norfolk and Essex, the land is sinking following the last ice age. Sea levels are rising. So you know, climate change is something that we have to consider the whole way through. And I just come from the Environment Agency. That's where I spent the last 5 years, and a lot of what we were doing was warning, informing the public, because in the last 5 years, we've had two big tidal surges. And of course, the North Sea is quite shallow. So, you know, we're not getting the hurricane scale tidal surges. But for us, we've got a lot of low lying land. A lot of it is below sea level. And, you know, we've got people protected by walls and embankments. But you get a deep depression coming down the North Sea, and you could see lots of flooding.
So what measures are you guys taking over there? And can you speak at all to how those measures compare to what's going on in the US? The approaches.
What do you mean? What measures do we take? So we have got, following flooding sort of in the 90s and noughties, something called the Flood Forecasting Center came into existence, and that was a combination with our Met Office, so our national weather supplier, and the Environment Agency. And the whole point of that was to take the weather information and then put the flooding information to it, and then give people a risk for what was going to occur. So, I mean, they're looking days and days out. I mean, we were able to see within 36 hours out, be able to give a forecast that was within 20 centimeters of the still water level, which is a, you know, 36 hours warning. You can get a lot done. Sleep doesn't feature in that 36 hours, but you can get a lot done. So, and one of the biggest challenges being on a coastal area, so I grew up in the middle of the country. I've only lived by the sea for 5 years. So one of the biggest challenges is getting people like me to understand what the tides mean. Yeah, you know, believe it or not, they come twice a day, but people don't understand that they come twice a day at different times, which is sounds crazy, but trying to work on that, you know, and equally trying to help them understand what a tidal surge is, because people, I mean, the word tidal wave really sends shudders down my spine. But it's not, you know, it's a bulge of water that's coming, and then you put the weather on top, and that can make some quite exciting winters.
Well, as Becky can tell you, and Kyle, there's a lot more to it than just the wave that comes in. You've got this, yeah. There's other stuff going on, continued rain and swollen rivers and all kinds of other things. So that's just the beginning. But I'm curious, Chris, what other kinds of regular natural disasters do you guys have there? Do you have earthquakes or tornadoes?
We are an old, cold bit of the Earth's crust. There's not a lot going on. I mean, the biggest earthquake, natural earthquakes we get are maybe four. So it might knock your pot off the shelf, rattle your light fittings. Nothing particularly big or dangerous. Nothing like you see over in sort of California size. Tornadoes. We do actually get a lot of tornadoes, but they are only little. In fact, my previous boss in Suffolk had one go through his farmyard, which was, took the roof off a couple of the barns. So we do get tornadoes. They do cause some very localized damage, but they don't get, and Becky will know more about this than I do, but they don't get to the scale you see sort of in Tornado Alley in the States. They tend to be quite focused, touch down and go. We don't see that. What we are susceptible to is deep Atlantic depressions that can bring some serious winds. In 2014, we saw that if you looked at the charts, you could see the storms lining up to come into England. And I'd never seen that. You know, you can see the one that's hitting you, and you can see the next two coming, which was quite interesting.
Wow. Well, I was in Scotland a couple of years ago, and it rains a lot.
Oh, yes.
In that part of the world. So
beautiful.
Are your conditions such that, you know, the ground is used to having all that moisture, and it doesn't really create huge problems if you have a big storm?
Rain. Talk about the rain that we get. A part of Essex, not too far from where I'm now, on average, and this gets less rain than Jerusalem. So there are parts of the country which are really get very little rain. You won't believe it today because winter's finally turned up. It's done nothing but raining, it's freezing cold. But we've, we get some areas get a lot of rain. 2-3 years ago, we saw in the Lake District enough, rain that fell and that lifted some of the lakes up nearly, 3-4 feet higher than they normally are, and saw, massive flooding across the Lake District. We've seen locally to us a storm that bubbled up over South Essex, and that in 4 hours dropped enough rain to fill Wembley Stadium on a very small area. So we can go from sort of real extremes, from some areas being really dry to some areas being very wet. We really, people always say about the Brits that we talk about the weather a lot, but we can some days have every season in a day.
sounds like my part of town, and maybe Baltimore. Any other weather thoughts, Becky?
I had one, and then I lost it. So it's mostly just the flooding, the occasional tornadoes, and that's more kind of more into Europe, not as much in the UK.
Yeah, it is mainly flooding.
And wind too, I think, right?
Yes. Yeah. And again, it depends on the track of the depressions that we get.
This may be an interesting question. How do you find the warning system from the UK Met Office? Because just as a bit of background, I love it. Full disclosure, it's much simpler than the US's. And so I was just curious what your thoughts are on it.
I really like it. And they've just recently added more to it. To add actually thunder and lightning as an additional, because we had issues in the summer where they'd put a warning for rain out and it could be 30 degrees outside. You ain't gonna rain today, and then the storm pops up above your head and you've got water through your front door. So they've added a warning for that, for those sort of sudden storms and the effects associated with lightning. But for us, that the three colors, you've got yellow, be aware, Amber, be prepared, and red, act. And they don't issue red warnings very often. And
when
you do see one, that's when you know you're going to get it. And the amber ones, and we use the amber ones because we do trust them. You know, they really do. They have got it absolutely nailed. The amber ones. So when we start as a resilience forum, start talking to each other. Okay, we've got an amber weather warning. What does this mean? And we get someone from the Met Office on the line who will tell all of the responding agencies at the same time, this is what's coming. And then we'll have a discussion around, what does that mean for our agency? Do we need any help? Is there nothing to see here? We're all right, but we can help others. Or for example, fire, if it's a wind one, our fire services will start thinking about, okay, we might need to clear roads. We might have, you know, trees down on houses. They start thinking about what kit to get out and check. If it's going to be rain, the environment agency get out and do the river runs. They will make sure that, you know, the key drainage areas and pinch points are clear. So they are really good.
So what's the reaction? Oh, go ahead.
No,
okay, I was just going to ask what. So that's the reaction to kind of the middle tier, if I'm understanding you. What would be the reaction to the red, which is, you know, once, twice a year, if that?
Once, twice a year, exactly the same reaction we get.
Okay, so it's still pretty calm, collected, just figuring out.
I mean, it changes the pace a little bit, you know. With if it's an amber, okay, we're ready. Let's not jump to, you know, and it depends where the tick of the box is. Is it a medium, you know, likelihood of significant impacts, or is it, you know, very likely of medium impacts? You sort of look at what they're saying the risk is, and take your lead from what our forecasters tell us to expect, and we roll from that. And equally, that rolls back to sort of what I'm doing now, is we will listen to what the Met Office says, and do we need to think about our vulnerable people in the community? If it's going to get suddenly very cold, we need to make sure that we get the message out to primary care, so that, you know, when they visit people, that they're checking their heating works.
Right.
Little things like that, because it's about keeping people out of hospital. You know, that's it.
Right.
Well, it's nice that at least the kinds of disasters you have, you can anticipate, unlike California and their earthquakes from whence I come. But I think I'm about ready to move to the UK. It sounds like, other than the rain, it's a pretty safe place to be. So that's a good thing. And it sounds like people do pay attention to the warnings that you put out, which is also a good thing.
They do within the sort of the responder community. And I think, you know, I don't think we're alone in saying, and I'm sure you guys have spoken about it many, many, many times. It's getting the public to respond. I mean, this podcast, we're talking to like-minded people. We see it, we act, we do something with that information. It's how do we get people to respond? Well, one of our challenges that we have over here is what stems back to 1987, when there was the hurricane that wasn't a hurricane, and massive disruption across the country, I'm told. I wasn't, you know, I was three, so I don't remember it. But it caused a lot of problems. And since then, there's always been that sort of, oh, the weatherman's always wrong. No, they're not. It's just that people understanding probabilities, and our role as emergency planners is to break that message down, get through to people, you know. And I talk to our providers and sort of give them the information, so that when they're working with patients, they can talk about it, and just, you know, it gets in there.
Well, I'm sure Becky loves that statement. She probably hates that other statement more than anything in the world. Meteorologists are always wrong. Well, so thanks, Chris. You validated all of our meteorologists. I'm kind of curious, you know, you listen to our podcast and how we do things over here. Is there any kind of similar podcast in the UK that deals with disasters and weather?
Not that I could find.
No. So you listen to us. I think that's pretty cool.
It is, and you know, we talk about the way that, you know, compare and contrast different setups. So, yeah, how do it, within your local areas, how do your responders come together? Do your responders come together to discuss local risks? Because we have a duty to risk assess and publish those risk assessments. Do you get together in the States and do that?
I don't know if it happens as much on a regular basis. Exercises are the best way to pull everybody together, and unfortunately it costs a lot of money to run them. So it kind of depends on the area. It depends if it's a larger county and they have the funding. You know, I'm sure they all have meetings from time to time. But again, the more successful ways of training and getting everybody involved is to have a big exercise, but they just don't seem to happen as often as they used to. And that's why I'm glad Joe's out there, Joe and Jim are out there doing what they do. I'm sure they have some level of communication on a regular basis, but it's different for each county, each state, you know, on how much effort they put into it, I suppose. Jamie, thoughts on that?
Well, I think the coordination's become much better since two different events, and you mentioned one of them, Chris, earlier, is 9/11, and it sounded like the challenges that happened in 9/11 had an impact on how things were done in the UK as well. It sounds like you did a little bit more communicating, which is one of the things that came out of the commission from 9/11, was that there were communication issues between agencies that needed to be fixed, and that was one big thing. The other one was Hurricane Katrina, which changed the way federal resources were deployed to support state and local resources. And so I think those two things really had an impact, so that now state-level emergency managers talk to county and municipal emergency managers on a more regular basis. When an event is pending, they will activate the emergency management systems in the relevant areas, and then, if needed, talk to the federal government and say, we need help. And that's where, if you hear any of the reports from the U.S., you'll hear us declare a disaster, which, by declaring the disaster at the state level, that allows certain laws to take effect for the federal government to come in and offer their services. But so that's kind of how things work here.
Very similar to the way that we declare a major incident, and believe it or not, until the sort of in 2004 and going forward, declare, you know, what is a major incident? Everyone has slightly different definitions. So following, we had with the London attacks in 2007 and various others, this we were driven to a principle called JESSEP was brought out. The Joint Emergency Service Interoperability Principles were brought together to try and break down some of those links. So now, I mean, there's an app you can download. The website's really good, even down to dictating what color high-vis vests different commanders will wear, how when we pass information to each other, we pass it the same way, and we call the same thing, you know, the same thing. It's really, really important, because you can end up at forward control points, forward operating bases, and so now it's just a FOP, a forward operating point. We keep it, everyone's saying the same thing.
Well, one thing I've noticed here is the addition of a lot more assets. And I think after some of our bigger incidents, that's really taxed the federal assets, which we've had many of lately. States have created teams that can function. So that's kind of an interim level. When it surpasses the state's ability to manage something, then they may go to the feds. Locally, they have medical reserve corps. They have CERT teams. They have people within a county or within a neighborhood that are training to help at that level. So I think that's something that's gotten better over time. Jamie, what do you think?
Well, I think absolutely that the training is improved, and it's one of those things we talk about all the time, right? I mean, we talk about the fact that after every major event, it's important to come together and pull those resources together that you used, what worked, what didn't work, what could be made better, and then apply those things to future training evolutions, to future manuals for response. And it's one of the things we talk about with Joe all the time when we talk about Paragon Medical Education Group and their sponsorship of this program. One of the reasons we do this show is because they wanted to have this discussion we're having right now. And so I would just like to thank them again, as always, for supporting the program. Joe's not here tonight, so I get to be Joe for a second and just, remind you that if you're looking for a way to bring in some real top flight experienced people, like people who went and responded with the USAR team for the storm surge in Mexico Beach, Florida, recently, those people can come to your jurisdiction and talk to you about collapsed structure search and rescue and recovery efforts in those major situations. And so you need to reach out to them and find out exactly how they can customize something that fits within both your budget and within your needs. And you can do that by heading over to ParagonMedicalGroup.com. You can also find them on Twitter at ParagonMedEDU. And you can always find links to them on our page at DisasterPodcast.com. So we thank them for their continued support, and we urge you to reach out to them, if only to say thank you for bringing you the Disaster Podcast.
I bet they'd even go to the UK.
I bet
somebody
they would.
Asked them.
Oh, they've been.
They go all over the world.
They've been to South America. They've done several things down in parts of South America, I know. So I'm sure they'd go internationally just about anywhere. Chris, thanks so much for coming on, and thanks for reaching out to us. This has been last couple of months. We've had several people in the community talk to us about how they can share back with the community, and I think that's so important. So I want to thank you for reaching out and talking to us about having this be a topic.
No problem at all. Thanks for having me on. Thanks for what you guys are doing. It's really important we get out there and sort of spread what we're doing and share learning.
Definitely. Is there a place you'd like to, if people wanted to kind of pick your brain about what kind of things you do in the UK, is there a place they can reach out to you? I don't know if you're active anywhere, or I guess in the Facebook
LinkedIn.
Group.
LinkedIn is probably the best
LinkedIn?
Place.
Okay.
Best place to find me, but I'm also in the Facebook group posting.
All right, great. Fantastic. Well, Chris, thanks for coming on. I appreciate it.
No problem at all. Thank
Absolutely.
You.
It was great fun, Chris.
Becky, where can folks find you?
Mainly on Twitter. I share a lot of weather stuff, some crisis and risk communication stuff. I'm also in the Facebook group, but if you want to follow me on Twitter and see all my random ramblings there, it's at WX_Bex.
Yep, and I'll have a link to that in the show notes as well for people that want to check on that. Becky always has some pretty interesting articles and things that she posts on Twitter, so it's well worth following her over there. Sam, how about you?
Well, you'll find me watching all of the tweets that Becky puts out. She's a Twitter-holic. But you can find me under Sam Bradley, SamBradley11, on all of the social media sites and certainly in the Facebook group and on the DisasterPodcast.com website. And Jamie?
Of course, you can find me under the handle PodMedic in most social media locations out there. So please friend, follow, or otherwise connect with me there. I'd love to hear from you. And always over at DisasterPodcast.com and on our Facebook group. So just search Facebook for Disaster Podcast and join the group. I think we're at 646 or 7 people. So we need to get up to that 650 mark, folks. So go find a friend and ask them to join the group. It's great to have you guys in there, and we have some great discussions. In fact, I posted some great articles that Dr. Ben Abo shared recently about some of the response to the recent synagogue shootings in Pittsburgh, both the physician response team and an article about the tactical medics that went in with the SWAT team and were treating the police officers that were shot in the exchange of gunfire. So check in and read those articles, leave comments, ask questions, and we can get a discussion going over there.
Ben's gonna come on with us as soon as we can get him scheduled.
Yep.
And talk about those things.
Yep, definitely. And Ben trained there in Pittsburgh, so he has a good, real affinity for that system. And we're hoping that he can maybe connect us, he and Joe can connect us with them. Once things settle down and get a little bit more back to normal there, we'll have some representatives from that system on to talk about some of the lessons they learned in this response. A lot going on, a lot coming up in the coming year for the Disaster Podcast, and we'll be staying on top of things as always. Sam, I'm glad we had Chris on tonight. It's been a good discussion and eye-opening for me, because it's always great to hear how other systems operate.
Well, I just like listening to them, frankly. But, you know, we have a lot of international folks in our community. We got to listen to this, Australians and New Zealanders. We'd love to have the same conversation with you. So please jump in and give us a shout, and we'll get you hooked up on the show. But, you know, there's a new tagline for tonight. International medicine is not our everyday medicine.